Good morning. I'd like to call the meeting to order. This is the Minnesota Senate Health and Human Services Committee, and it is Tuesday, February 18th, 2025. We do have a quorum present, and we will be taking up five bills today. Our first bill on the agenda is Senate File 1503, Senator Uma Verbaeten. Welcome to the HHS committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I see you have an A1 amendment, an author's amendment. Is Senator Mann, could you move the A1 amendment?
So moved, Madam Chair.
This is an author's amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Any opposed? The amendment is adopted. Again, please go ahead and present your bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1503 would eliminate facility fees, and facility fees allow systems to add on fees that are unrelated to the cost of care we receive. They are based on a clinic's affiliation with a nearby hospital. Facility fees don't improve the value or outcome of a doctor's visit for a patient. They simply improve the profit line for healthcare companies. These fees are predatory, unpredictable, and very hard to avoid. And I'm so grateful to my constituent, Melissa Finnegan, who's here with me today, for bringing this issue to me. You'll get to hear her story in a moment, but first, I'd like to share how these fees work and what my bill does. I have shared with all of you a report from the Public Interest Research Group on facility fees, and as the title states, hospitals charge fees for care at the doctor's office. This report highlights that facility fees are really a direct result of consolidation. When hospitals acquire clinics and practices, they can raise prices by charging facility fees due to their new hospital affiliation. So patients can receive these fees for routine visits like blood tests, COVID tests, x-rays, and there are three particularly outrageous instances where patients are charged these facility fees. The first is when they seek preventative care. So things like vaccines, mammograms and screenings, and even though with most healthcare plans, legally there should be no out-of-pocket cost to patients for these types of services. The second is when patients have just been evaluated but haven't received treatment, and those are known as evaluation and management claims. And the third is telehealth appointments. So patients can be charged these facility fees when they have not even stepped into a facility at all. Facility fees are driving up healthcare costs, and a patient who would normally be responsible for a small copay is now stuck with a huge bill. And these fees can vary tremendously. So they could add anywhere from a few dollars to thousands to a bill. And in many cases, like Melissa's, the facility fee is actually greater than the charge for the actual care provided. These can really add up, especially when you're going for routine care or for follow-up appointments. Because facility fees are charged separately from professional services, they are not always subject to the same plan design requirements, such as caps on annual out-of-pocket costs. And in some instances, facility fees are not covered by insurance at all. Some insurers negotiate with health systems to avoid facility fees or refuse to cover it in certain circumstances, and that is then passed on to patients. And the solution isn't to ask our insurance companies to pay for facility fees. If they take on that responsibility, those additional costs will still be passed on to patients in the form of higher insurance premiums or cost sharing. I also want to note that patients get little notice of these fees, and they're usually only finding out when they receive the bill. Though in Minnesota we currently require providers to give notice of facility fees, it's pretty weak in practice, and providers can provide this notice on their website or through signage at a facility. Again, you'll hear about Melissa's experience with this, but most people are not checking the website beforehand or reading, you know, the fine print on a sign when they walk in. And lastly, I just want to say that these facility fees are hard to avoid. So insurance requirements such as, you know, referrals or prior authorization will limit patients' choices. And because patients also must consider what's in network and where appointments are available, that also is going to limit their choices. Patients in rural areas have even fewer choices. If there's only, you know, a nearby clinic and it happens to be affiliated with a hospital, they could be stuck paying these facility fees with really nowhere else to go. So I want to just walk through what my bill does. The first section in Subdivision 1 just defines facility fees, providers, and clinics. Subdivision 2 prohibits the facility fees for non-emergency services that are provided at a provider-based clinic, including telehealth services. Subdivision 3 prohibits facility fees regardless of where they are provided for outpatient evaluation and management services. It also prohibits facility fees for outpatient diagnostic imaging services that are identified by MDH if they determine these services can be reliably provided safely and effectively in settings other than hospitals. Subdivision 4 requires health systems and hospitals to report to MDH the facility fees they charged in the previous year. There are a number of things outlined in that report. Subdivision 5 is rulemaking provision for MDH, and then Subdivision 6 is enforcement. So a violation would be considered an unlawful business practice, and the Attorney General would have authority to enforce. It also gives MDH authority to impose penalties for non-compliance. MDH could impose administrative penalties not exceeding $1,000 per occurrence. And it also gives MDH the ability to audit any healthcare provider for compliance with this section. And then Section 2 repeals what was the facility fee disclosure law. I also want to note that other states have done this. So Connecticut has banned all facility fees. Colorado has banned facility fees for preventative care. Ohio has banned facility fees for telehealth services. Texas has banned facility fees for drive-through vaccination and other health service locations. And then many of these states have also strengthened those patient notification requirements. So in Texas, they require providers to disclose to patients the facility's median fee, the range of fees, and then the facility contact information. And then in Connecticut and Colorado, they require written notice of facility fees and the amount of the fee at the time of scheduling an appointment. And Colorado requires this notice to be in plain language. So I'll just conclude again by recapping that the rise in these fees is driven by consolidation of healthcare providers. Facility fees are charged in some really outrageous scenarios, including when patients seek preventative care, are being merely evaluated but not treated, when they access telehealth and never even enter a facility. The facility fees are driving up healthcare costs for consumers, and they do really add up. Facility fees are directly passed on to patients without transparency, equity, or strong notification requirements. Facility fees are hard to avoid, especially for patients in rural areas. And no one, not even our insurance plans, should be paying for facility fees. Patients really deserve protection from these facility fees. Thank you.
Thank you. And you have several testifiers. First, Melissa Finnegan, please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Melissa Finnegan, and since many of you do already know me, I want to be clear that my efforts on this bill are purely personal and do not represent the position of any of my employers, previous or current. But I do want to share with you what inspired me to work with Senator Umu Verbeten to develop this legislation. I have a little four-year-old girl named Natalie. And since she learned to speak, Natalie has been telling us that her tummy hurts. Her primary care provider referred us to the pediatric gastroenterologist specialist at the MHealth Fairview Voyager Pediatric Specialty Clinic. Now, that doctor ruled out anything truly scary, but she did recommend regular six-month follow-ups, thinking that as Natalie grows and her language develops, she can tell us more about what she's feeling and we can understand how to help her. So last April, my husband Patrick took Natalie to one of these follow-up appointments. The clinic took her vital signs, and then Natalie played with cars on the floor, Well, Patrick and the doctor discussed her medication, eating habits, bowel movements, etc. It was a basic appointment that lasted about 15 minutes. Imagine our surprise when the bill came. We had a $201 charge for the doctor's services, which made sense, but the bill also included $423 for outpatient hospital services. You can imagine our confusion since our child didn't set foot inside a hospital for this appointment. After several rounds of customer service calls to both our health insurance and mHealth Fairview, we learned that this charge was a facility fee that mHealth Fairview was allowed to charge us because the clinic was affiliated with a hospital. No extra care or services were provided for this fee, and the clinic is not physically located within the hospital. So I looked into existing state law surrounding facility fees and discovered Minnesota Statute 62J.824, and that statute requires facilities to notify patients in advance of an appointment that they may be charged this facility fee. And as Senator Umu-Verbaten said, this also applies to telehealth visits, so you don't have to set foot into the facility to be charged this fee. And then paragraph B requires the facility to post the same information on their website and in spaces accessible by patients. So looking at that advance notification requirement, I asked mHealth Fairview to show me the documentation of when we were notified of the possibility of this fee. I have a busy life. I'm willing to admit that I could have missed it, but after several rounds of asking, they admitted that they view the sign at the clinic as the notification. I will challenge anyone who has gotten a three-year-old ready for an appointment into their car seat, driven them across town, gotten them out of the car seat, through a busy parking lot, to notice a sign when they're probably already late for the appointment, and then call their insurance company to see if they might be charged an extra fee of an unknown amount. Additionally, a complicated sign in English at a facility is not adequate notification for anyone who is visually impaired or who does not read English. A photo of this sign should be in your packet. So ultimately, it appears to me that these facility fees are another way for Minnesotans to be price gouged out of getting the healthcare that they need, and current law offers inadequate protection. Now, my family is privileged enough that we were able to absorb a surprise $400 fee, but we know that not all Minnesota families can. Additionally, because we live in the metro, we have some luxury of choice, and we were luckily able to find another provider for Natalie who does not charge this fee. But we know that families in greater Minnesota may not have this opportunity. That is why Patrick and I reached out to our state legislator about pursuing legislation to stop this practice from harming Minnesota families who are just trying to access the health care that they need. Thank you for listening to our story, and I am happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Ben Baglio. I'm sorry, Ben. I think I messed up your last name. And please, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Chair Wicklund and committee members. My name is Ben Baglio, and I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify today on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association, or MNA, which represents over 22,000 nurses working at the bedside in hospitals across our state. In recent years, MNA has supported a number of proposals that would bring about greater financial transparency at hospitals and across our healthcare system, which includes greater accountability for the so-called nonprofits that own or operate the vast majority of hospitals in our state. So MNA is proud to support this bill for those very reasons. It would bring about more transparency to healthcare billing in our state, which patients desperately need, and it would hold hospitals and other providers accountable for unduly nickeling and diming patients simply because they've gotten so big and gobbled up so many hospitals and clinics across the state that they can exercise their monopoly power or otherwise outsized market power to do so. To be clear, when these big health chains charge these fees, and when you actually dig into the data about who they are charging and why, there really is no rhyme or reason. It varies considerably, and it seems the only ones who can answer why they are picking winners and losers are the hospital systems themselves. People cannot afford to pay these fees for routine services at clinics. As health systems continue to consolidate and buy up physician practices and clinics, more patients than ever are facing facility fees for bills on regular doctor visits. If you're living in greater Minnesota or in many pockets of the metro, these fees hit you the hardest because in many cases the only health care provider located in your community is a facility that the big health chains have classified as a health-based clinic, meaning you're going to pay those extra fees each and every time you visit your doctor. Facility fees do not indicate quality of care, nor do they are they actually used to cover any costs that could even be remotely associated with an individual patient's particular visit, the services received, or any pertinence to the facility where that visit occurred. Facility fees exist simply to improve the profit margins for healthcare corporations that own multiple locations, which in turn actually incentivizes these massive systems to gobble up even more smaller independent hospitals or clinics, or to cut services from larger hospitals in favor of small clinics where they can charge these additional fees. Minnesota patients are sick and tired of being nickeled and dimed, especially by big corporations that don't have to pay most local, state, or federal taxes, which is the case for almost all of Minnesota's big health systems. We urge the legislature to prioritize financial transparency and accountability in our healthcare system and to disincentivize healthcare consolidation, which we see this bill addressing issues on both fronts. We thank Senator Umu-Betten for putting patients before profits and authoring this bill, and to Chair Wicklund and the committee for allowing me to speak today. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll have Joe Schindler. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schindler, and please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Joe Schindler, and I'm the Vice President of Finance at the Minnesota Hospital Association. I've been at the MHA for 38 years, and the last few years have been some of the toughest financial years that our hospitals have faced. 40% of our nonprofit hospitals are in the red, according to our last audited financial data. I want to express our opposition to Senate File 1503 and its negative impact on hospital finances. Minnesota's not-for-profit hospitals are safety nets for their communities. They provide 24/7 by 365 days a year for everyone, regardless of their ability to pay. Hospitals also provide a great span of outpatient clinic services to improve access to patient care, such as diagnostic imaging, laboratory services, infusions, and other outpatient therapy services. It's been a long-standing federal policy to allow for both a professional fee and a facility fee to be billed for clinic services. Professional fee pays for the healthcare provider's work, while the facility fee covers the associated costs associated with equipment, medical supplies, maintenance, building infrastructure, and support staff. Pulling funding from the hospitals at a time when finances are already upside down would further accelerate the potential closure of services. Of course it costs more to be open 24 hours a day. Of course it costs more to provide care free of charge to the uninsured. Of course, hospitals see a higher proportion of Medicare and Medicaid patients. And generally, hospital-based clinics have sicker and older patients than your average sports medicine clinic would not. By the way, private for-profit physician clinics also charge for their overhead costs, but they do not show up on a bill. These expenses are just built into their charges. In addition, MHA is particularly concerned about the open-ended language in the bill to limit facility fees for any other services identified by the Commissioner of Health. This direct authority over provider funding should not be part of the MDH scope of work. They are responsible for licensing, public health, and data tracking. Legislators should be making these important decisions, not regulators. In closing, hospitals will continue to put patients first. We understand that no one likes getting a health care bill, but eliminating this long-standing funding source without alternatives does not make the cost go away. In reality, this policy change may be jeopardizing the very outpatient services that our communities have come to expect. Thank you.
Thank you. And last, we have a testifier who is on Zoom. Dr. Dana Seifert, if you can unmute and let us know you're there.
Good morning.
Good morning. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wicklund and committee members, for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate File 1503. My name is Dana Seifert. My husband, Mike, and I operate Ravenview Farm in Jordan, where he is also president, and I am treasurer for the Scott County chapter of the Minnesota Farmers Union. I'm also a physical therapist who earned my doctorate at the University of Minnesota and a board-certified clinical specialist with over 12 years spent working for both small, independently run practices along with large health systems. The views I share today are completely my own and in no way represent the official views of any healthcare system or practice that I've worked for in the past or currently. In my experience, facility fees have become a leverage factor, making it more difficult for freestanding clinics or private practices to avoid buyouts, helping to drive the spiraling consolidation we see throughout our healthcare system. I've seen how facility fees incentivize health systems to prioritize the acquisition of smaller practices, like the privately owned pediatric therapy clinic TheraPlay, being bought out by the Mayo Clinic Health System in New Prague, Minnesota, with following changes leading to the resignation of the very skilled occupational therapist who had opened and run the clinic for years beforehand. The big system could have opened their own pediatric department, which would have increased choice for the community and where they sought services for their children. Instead, Mayo decided to stop paying rent on the TheraPlay clinic and brokered a deal allowing Mayo to buy the separate building where they'd previously rented space to provide outpatient adult physical therapy. Now, that building had also housed the community fitness center. This deal pushed the community center into smaller premises, making it lose about 80% of the square footage it had previously had, and requiring senior citizens, many of whom had just recently had joint surgery for which they were receiving physical therapy, to now go up and down at least one, if not two, flights of stairs to access their community health center to maintain their progress. Consolidation is a key driver of the high healthcare costs and reduced access to services that are hurting rural communities across Minnesota, not to mention limiting healthcare providers the opportunities to continue to practice. On a personal note, my second cousin, twice removed, which is my grandpa's cousin in plain English, was Sister Jenna Rose Gervais. She served as the administrator and executive director of St. Mary's Hospital during their merger with the Mayo Clinic, and was the first woman to sit on the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Board in 1979. No slouch when it came to the business side of healthcare. A saying she was well known for was often half quoted by Mayo executives: no money, no mission. Sister Jenna Rose never shied from politely but firmly pointing out whenever they forgot the final part of her admonition: no mission, no need for the money. The bigger the healthcare system, the flimsier the excuse for needing facility fees for non-emergency care at hospital-owned outpatient clinics. SF-1503 can help redress this imbalance by removing the incentive to seek acquisitions for the purposes of charging facility fees. I want to thank Senator Omuva-Bayton for bringing this legislation forward and urge the committee to support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Members, now do you have any questions? Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, and I know we have a lot of work, so I'm not going to ask many questions, but nobody has talked to me about this, but it seems like it's just another bad idea where we're just trying to, you know, maybe have some abusive fees on people. It's too bad we can't fund our hospitals correctly, like rebasing and the things we've done in the past. And I mean, I'm not here on a rant this morning, but it's like somebody's made choices as the legislature about how we're going to spend money, and hospitals have been lacking in that. And if they have to rely on this sort of a fee to, you know, gouge people, I guess that's too bad. Is this going to stay here today, Madam Chair?
Senator Abler, this bill has to go to judiciary and state and local governments.
Okay, so that's fine. Well, I think I'd be supporting that. But so I just have like one question. And so with these fees, Is every patient charged this, including medical assistance clients, or just people who were non-medical assistants? Does anybody know that?
Senator Umover-Brayton?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Abler. I'd like to verify, but my understanding is that everyone is, there's an ability to charge any patient this fee. Really, it's just, is the clinic associated with a hospital, then you can charge that fee. Like I said, there's preventative, you know, care that folks will seek that really should have no out-of-pocket costs, and yet you'll still see a facility fee pop up because it's really just due to their affiliation with a hospital.
Senator Abler.
Well, and I don't know, maybe there's more of the story to hear from the hospital folks, but I think you're on the wrong side of this. And just going forward, if you're, I think the MDH shouldn't be given too much authority, and I think you want to spell out what they can do. I think that concern is valid. But I think it just seems like this is a bad thing. I think I'm going to add on to the bill. Thank you.
Any other members? Questions? Senator Coran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I kind of share some of the same concerns Senator Abler has. I think the transparency issue or the rules created this process. And I don't think this fixes it. I think the transparency must be addressed in how do we fund them, because the costs don't go away for the entire healthcare system. And you made it, one of the statements that in response to Senator Abler's is no out of, you know, some of these services are when no out-of-pocket costs should be incurred for some routine. The problem is all of those services are provided at great cost. And the more we mandate those, the greater pressure we put on all other aspects of trying to cover the costs of the healthcare system. And so I don't think this is the right solution, especially when you look at granting unlimited rulemaking authority to Department of Health in deciding what other services shouldn't be billable. Where does that end? And that is truly our responsibility. There is no sunset on rulemaking. Even for the short implementation or even a review period. And so I think I'm against rulemaking unlimited in the first place. That's our job. That's the legislature's job. Put some guidelines and guardrails around that when we do choose to use rulemaking or grant it. So I don't think it's the right solution. I think the holistic review the holistic healthcare system from the federal on down are putting these pressures on all of our hospitals. Yes, it's the transparency piece, everybody should be aware. And maybe that's the issue. Itemize all of them so everybody goes in eyes wide open. We've done a lot of work on those things, right, in pharmacy and all of those things. To me, that's a better solution than granting a state agency lawmaking authority without us after this process. So thank you.
Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Umover-Brayton, for bringing this bill. I sent you an email during this hearing to ask to be a co-author of it. I also appreciate the testifier invoking Sister Generos. I had the pleasure of knowing Sister Generos, and I think of her words often about no mission, no money, no money, no mission. I think about that a lot. And we should have more conversations about costs of healthcare and ways to address that. And there are other things we should be having, you know, conversations about in that space, but pushing costs onto patients is not the solution, is not the right thing to do, and especially in a way that is not transparent, that doesn't align with the care that they are actually receiving. So I think this is the right thing to do, and we should be having many other conversations about ways to address the rising healthcare costs, but this, pushing it onto patients, contributes to ongoing medical debt, contributes to many other issues that aren't what we should be providing to patients. And so I appreciate you bringing this forward, and we'll watch as it progresses through other committees. Thank you.
Senator Utke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't want to, again, repeat a lot of what's been said, but my concern is this bill will do nothing to reduce costs. It only shifts them. Our providers, they don't have extra money the way it is. And so to keep their doors open, they have to shift them. You know, it was stated that 40% of our rural safety net hospitals were running in the red. It wasn't just last session we were hearing that number was 2/3 of all of them. I think it's even higher than what's being stated. And without them, I mean, we already have in our rural areas where it takes 45 minutes or an hour to get to a hospital. And if we start to lose some of those where all of a sudden we're looking at an hour or 2 hours, it's just unacceptable. And so are healthcare costs high? Yes, they are. But I just don't think this approach is what is going to help anything. Why don't we reduce some of the incredible mandates that have been put on them over the last number of years that are costing them a lot of money and providing zero care? They do not improve care at all. So that's part of what we need to look at if we're going to actually move the needle on this. But I do have a question in here, too. Just looking at the way the bill was written, and it refers in the definition section, it refers to 145B. And it may be something that just a technical change down the road will change, but that particular chapter is only for living wills, and it's spelled out as such. And here we're talking about something totally different. I would imagine the definition remains the same if it falls into the right category, but it just needs to be changed. I see a nod.
Mr. Hidalgo, do you have a comment about that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Ruckey. Yes, that's a very good point. There is actually surprisingly not a great definition in our state law for providers. It's found in a variety of different places. That particular definition is, I believe, well suited for this particular usage. But I do take your point that it's an odd place to pull the definition from. So that certainly could be considered. I don't think it has an inappropriate usage for the providers that are intended to be captured under this bill. Thank you.
Senator Adkey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you. I think the definition is totally appropriate. It just, when you go to the chapter, it says it's specific. So that's something for down the road. But a question for our bill author is, will this bill give the agency the ability to cut or reduce payments to the hospitals?
Senator Umover-Brayton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator. Subdivision 5 of Section 1 is where you see the rulemaking, and I feel like what we try to do is actually put some parameters around that. So MDH can adopt rules to include additional outpatient diagnostic imaging or other services. And that's really if they determine that they can reliably be provided safely and effectively in settings other than hospitals. Because again, what's happening here is those facility fees are being charged at a clinic that just happens to be associated with a hospital. So that's kind of the narrow definition of the rulemaking that MDH has in this bill.
Senator Adkey.
So just for clarity, it does allow them to make adjustments to their payments, right?
Senator Umover-Brayton.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. It's really around what they are allowed to, what facility fees MDH determined should be prohibited. So those specific categories there are what are listed. Outpatient diagnostic imaging, if they can determine that it's safe to provide that outside of a hospital setting.
Senator Adkey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nothing more.
Okay. Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Umover-Brayton, for bringing this bill. I've become familiar with these fees over the last few years, and they're a huge surprise when they happen, and there's very little you can do to do anything other than just pay them. I think the really critical piece of this is there are a lot of different reasons and locations around our state where a patient doesn't have a different choice. Mm-hmm. They can't choose to go to a different clinic because there might not be one within several hundred miles. The provider that they need to see is at a particular clinic. This is not an option that patients have to say, I'm not going to do this. When your kid needs care, you get your kid care. And when you don't have the option to go somewhere else, this is just now a mandatory fee that you have no control over and is not, as you said, helping your care in any way. I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about we need to protect the clinics, we need to make sure that they don't close, and that's absolutely true. But also, if the clinics are there but patients can't afford the care, they're not doing the thing that we need them to do. So I really appreciate you bringing this bill. I look forward to having it move forward.
Any other questions or comments? I don't see any others. Senator Umover-Bayton, did you have any final comments? Or?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the folks who came in to testify. And I really appreciated from hearing from Minnesota Farmers Union, just one of the problems here is that these, when you're able to charge these fees at a clinic just solely based on your association with the hospital, it really is incentivizing more consolidation and then putting our independent clinics at risk. So I think that's another important element to highlight for folks.
Thank you, and thank you for bringing the bill forward. Thank you, your testifiers, for working with you, your constituent working with you, and I do think that the burden has become an outsized burden on the patient with lack of control and lack of transparency, and I look forward to seeing how your bill moves forward. Members, let's see, Senator Mann, could you make the motion to recommend that Senate File 1503, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary?
So moved, Madam Chair.
And members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
The motion does prevail. Senate File 1503, as amended, has passed and will be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Thank you very much. Next, we'll go to Senate File 91. Senator Hoffman. Oh, are we going to do... we were going to do Senate File 91 because we have a testifier, an audience member, who needs to go somewhere else. But if Senator Rasmussen... Is that okay? If we do Senate... Okay, so let's do Senate File 91.
You'd be in the middle.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. And are you, let's see, I see an A2 amendment. Are you considering that you're an author's amendment that you'd like to move?
Madam Chair, if I could, I want to move on the A2 amendment, lines 1.1 and to 1.14.
Okay. You just want to take up the A2 amendment, or are you trying to amend the A2?
No, yeah, take up the A2 amendment, and I amend it. The bottom, the 1.15 on down is not needed, so I just need 1.1 to 1.14.
Ms. Hoffman, can we do this in one motion, or, okay, can you state the motion for us, please?
Yep. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Hoffman moves to divide the A2 amendment into two parts. Part one is lines 1.1 to 1.14, and part two is lines 1.15 to 1.27, and he, I believe, is just moving the first part.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Members, are you clear on the motion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
And do we need to... do the other part, or can we just leave it?
No.
You just don't want to adopt that. Okay. Senator Hoffman, please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Wicklund and members. And so Senate File 91 is a necessary initiative that continues the existing child care licensing flexibility that has been in place since 2023. The amendment that you all just voted on, it solidifies this, and right now I have Claire Sanford and I believe Jen Orth. She has to leave, so I'm going to turn it over to Claire Sanford in the interest of time, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for sponsoring this, Senator Hoffman. My name is Claire Sanford, and I am the Government Relations Chair on the board of the Minnesota Child Care Association. We are having our day on the Hill today, and I know many of you will be visited by our providers later, so please be on your best behavior. This bill is, as Senator Hoffman said, just a continuation of what is currently in law that was passed in 2023. It is a staffing flexibility for child care centers. It is currently set to sunset this July, and basically the amendment that Senator Hoffman just did is to remove that sunset. So this is something child care providers have been living with and into for 18 months. It's working well. You'll hear more about that in a second. And what it does is allow aides in child care centers to be alone with children for up to 25% of the day with some guardrails. Those aides must be at least 18 years of age. They must have been employed at the center for at least 30 days. So we're not leaving children alone with people in classrooms where someone just came off the street yesterday and doesn't know the children or know the program. And as an additional safeguard, if that aide happens to not yet have been employed by a center for 90 days before they could serve in this capacity, they would need to have completed all of the required licensing training that is required in a staff member's first 90 days, but they would have to complete it sooner to be able to take on this additional responsibility. So that's what the bill does, and I would like to turn it over to MCCA member Jen Orth to talk about how this affects her program. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jen Orth, and I am the owner of High Point Child Care, which operates two locations in Lakeville and Rosemont. I'm here today to express my strong support for Senate File 91 and to share the significant impact this policy has had on my child care programs. This legislation is essential to the continued success of child care centers across our state. Without it, we will face increased staff burnout, high turnover rates, and operational challenges that directly affect the quality of care and education we provide to young children. In September of 2024, my centers were forced to reduce operating hours due to staffing shortages. This was a difficult decision as we knew it would affect families who relied on care during those cut hours. Even with this adjustment, we continue to operate 10 and a half hours each day, with children there for 8.5 to 10 hours. Our staff members work 8-hour shifts, creating staffing challenges at both the beginning and the end of the day. The core of our educational day occurs between 9 a.m. and 4:30, with the hours before and after serving as transitional time for drop-off, breakfast, pickup, and free play. When aides are permitted to supervise up to 25% of the day independently, they can manage the morning and late afternoon transitions, allowing our teachers to be scheduled during critical learning times. With this flexibility, I have been able to schedule teachers more strategically, ensuring they are present when their experience is the most needed, rather than requiring them to cover early mornings and late evenings. This has significantly reduced the need for overtime, which is critical in preventing burnout and keeping the cost of childcare lower, which is a pressing issue in early childhood these days. More importantly, allowing aides to supervise up to 25% of the day independently has had no negative impact on the quality of care, safety, or well-being of the children at our centers. Instead, it has fostered a more balanced and sustainable work environment while maintaining a high standard our families have known to expect. On a personal level, this policy has allowed me the flexibility to be present for my own children, seeing them off to school in the morning or welcoming them home in the afternoon, something that was not possible under previous regulations. Before this legislation, I often had to cover early morning and late afternoon shifts myself, contributing to my own stress and burnout. This additional time with my children has been invaluable, and I sincerely hope it remains unchanged. If we revert to previous regulations, the negative impact on staff retention, burnout, and overall stability of childcare programs will be significant. I urge you to support Senate File 91 to ensure that child care providers can maintain high-quality programs while addressing the workforce challenges that are critical to our field. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Hoffman, any other remarks?
No, Madam Chair and members, it's just a continuation of what we did in this committee 2 years ago for our child care providers. So thank you.
Members, do you have any questions? Senator Utke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question to the bill, but just a question on the procedure. We split the A2 amendment past the top half. Do we have to act on the bottom half to delete it, or just it
no.
dies?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? No? Well, seeing no other questions, I do think that this seems like it has been a good opportunity to study the staffing change, and you know, seeing that it has been working and has been successful, making this change to make it permanent seems like a logical step. Senator Hoffman, this bill, now that we made that amendment, it doesn't need to go to any other committees.
Go to the floor.
And we can pass
General
it.
Orders.
we can pass it and just, you know, have it go to the floor, or we can lay it over for inclusion in some other bill later. Do you have a preference?
Oh, let's go to the floor with it. Yeah, we might as well. Let's get some work done. Yeah.
That was what I expected you to say. But.
Not that I bug you all the time about this. That's the first time I asked you this year, send it to the floor, Madam Chair. So I did back off a little bit.
So can you, is your motion, Senator Hoffman, to recommend that Senate File 91, as amended, be recommended to pass? Is that your motion?
Madam Chair, I recommend that it, as amended, be passed and placed on general orders.
Okay. That's fine. All right. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion does prevail, and Senate File 91, as amended, is passed and placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. And now we'll take up Senator Rasmussen, Senate File 446. Welcome, Senator Rasmussen. Please, do you have an amendment? And you don't have an amendment, so please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Senate File 446 today. This bill would allow out-of-home respite for children to be offered in an unlicensed setting. And again, just to clarify, the providers are still licensed, but this would make sure that respite as a vital service that supports families throughout the state, that families have access to safe and reliable respite options that are crucial for families needing to take a break from their caregiving responsibilities. Back in 2020, a change was made to where out-of-home respite for children could be provided, limiting the service to only licensed settings. This change resulted in the loss of trusted options for families and reduced the service's availability, especially in rural communities. The reason that we're here in the committee today is that if you look at subdivision 2 of the bill, there's an exemption to very clearly state that this bill does not impact respite care services to children in foster care. And so this bill, Madam Chair, has had a hearing in the Human Services Committee, and the reason I believe it's in this committee today is because it references Chapter 260C and 260D, but just to be clear, it's actually exempting and making sure that this bill does not impact respite care for services for children in foster care. I also have Sarah Grafstrom from ARM with today, who can provide testimony and answer any questions, depending on how deep the committee wants to get into this issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Grafstrom. If you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom. I am the Senior Director of State and Federal Policy at ARM. Just for those that aren't familiar, ARM is a trade association of residential service providers providing services through the 4 disability waivers and supporting people in a variety of different living environments, from a 4-person CRS to services that are provided in their own home. As Senator Rasmussen said, this bill was heard in Human Services about a week ago, so I know many of you have already heard this bill in that committee, but excited to talk to you again about the important provisions that we're moving forward. So the bill in front of you today is specific to out-of-home respite for individuals that are under 18 that are receiving services through one of the four disability waivers under a 245D licensed provider. As Senator Rasmussen said, in 2020, a change was implemented by the Department of Human Services that restricted where this type of respite could be provided. Prior to 2020, the service could be provided in a licensed 245D setting or in an unlicensed setting, as long as the provider had a 245D license and appropriate approval was received from the child's case manager and guardian. So an example of what this service might look like that I like to share is a retired special education teacher who has a strong relationship with family in her community and provides respite in her personal home maybe a couple weekends a year. With the change that was implemented in 2020, that teacher could no longer provide the service in her personal home unless she had that home licensed. The change drastically reduced the amount of available respite, specifically in greater Minnesota, where finding a licensed setting with an opening for respite can be hard to come by. And the loss of respite options has contributed to some families going into crisis and having to seek other options like emergency rooms or more congregate living settings. So the bill in front of you will allow for this service to once again be provided in an unlicensed setting, and there are certain parameters and qualifications that need to be met in order to move forward with this service in the unlicensed setting. So first, a background study must be completed for everyone who will be present in the home. The child's case manager must conduct and document an assessment of the home. The child's guardian or legal representative must visit the home before the kiddo goes to the home for respite. The service must be provided in a residential setting. No more than four children can receive the service at any one time, and everyone needs to have their own bedroom, except if they're siblings, and then they can share a bedroom. Services cannot be provided to children and someone over the age of 21 at the same time, and kiddo can only be in an unlicensed respite setting for 10 consecutive days and no more than 46 days in a calendar year. So just to conclude, we know that respite is a critical upstream service that supports families, and without access to reliable and safe respite, families are turning to alternative placements for their children. We're grateful for the department's collaboration on this legislation, and we're hopeful that by passing this bill, families will be able to find options for their children in their own communities where they feel safe and comfortable. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a really, I think, an important small project. It is amazing how highly regulated our society has become and how endlessly regulated this particular niche is. So it's a welcome change. And Madam Chair, when the time comes, I'd be happy to make the motion to send the bill wherever Senator Rasmussen wants to send it. So anyway, I hope we can get this done. Thank you.
Senator Kupick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a very good bill, and we know that many people who are taking care of individuals, the respite care is really crucial to them. I do have one question that just kind of flagged my eye. On line 2.112, it says 46 calendar days, and I thought, that is a really very random number. Is there some? I'm like, it's not divisible by seven, so it's not weeks. What is 46 calendar days? And is it just some kind of weird state law, or just, I don't know, 46 sounded good?
Ms. Grastrom?
Chair Wicklund, Senator Kupick, I would have to go back and reread some of the emails that went back and forth with the department, but I believe the rationale behind that was maybe a couple weekends a month and then a longer vacation time. So if there is a week of vacation, and that added up to 46 calendar days.
Senator Kupick.
Okay, thank you. Sometimes the way we arrive at numbers is very strange, but just thanks. Thanks for that clarification.
Thank you. Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question. I think it is worth emphasizing the importance of respite care and what that means for families. And I think any ways that we can improve access to families for respite care while keeping everyone safe is really important. We know that not having accessible respite care contributes to burnout, contributes to folks being placed in other congregate settings or other out-of-home placement. ER visits, increased costs of care. And so just thank you for bringing this, because families having access to that respite care is so important.
Great. Any other questions or comments? Senator Rasmussen, any final thoughts?
I appreciate the committee's support, and many of you are co-authors on this bill or have carried similar bills in the past, including Senator Bolden, and so appreciate the continued support on this important issue.
Thank you. And it does seem like the testimony that we heard in Human Services, it really is essential that we try and find ways, better ways, to allow people to get access to respite care. So this does seem like a good bill. This bill needs to go back to Human Services. So if you want to make that motion, Senator Abler, that...
Sure, I'll make that motion. Thank you.
Senator Abler moves that Senate File 446... is recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Human Services. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion does prevail, and Senate File 446 is referred to the Committee on Human Services. Thank you. And now we have Senate File 684. Senator Hoffman.
We're going to lay it over. We're going to set it right to the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I jokingly said to Senator Rasmussen, you know, I think we'll pass it out of Human Services. And he said to me on his way out, Jim, we already did. So, Senate File 684 is a notice to the reviser of statutes for federal approval of legislative enactments and its clarifying provision. Dear Chair Wicklin and others, it's common for Human Services and Health and Human Services bills to note a provision is effective upon federal approval. That happens a lot and has for many years. After passing legislation, we then, the body, often review the legislation we passed, and we work to continue refining or updating the statute as we gain new information. Sometimes, while drafting new legislation, we are unaware of an existing pending federal approval. And that, not knowing the status of that federal approval, makes it very challenging for us to do our work in the human services world. When you do that, this bill in front of you does not create a new process. Let me be very clarified on that. It codifies the existing process that we have, and it ensures everyone involved in developing legislation knows what has federal approval or not. Senate File 684 is intended to create a more efficient internal process that would benefit all of us. It requires that the Department of Human Services notify the reviser of statute of each enacted provision contained an effective date contingent on federal approval and when that federal approval is obtained for any such provision. This language that is in front of you provides an outline of how often the updates are provided, who is included in the report, and contains the parameters of what information is provided. Examples of those parameters include listing provisions that received federal approval, the date federal approval for each provision was received, and if no provisions have received federal approval, the report must state the fact. It's already something that we have. We're just codifying it so there's complete transparency on what we're doing and what we're not doing. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions about the bill? No questions. Okay. This bill we are going to lay over because disappointing, but we will lay it over and for possible inclusion in another bill later on in the session. So
you're good. Thank you.
Senate File 684 is laid over. And now we will move on to Senate File 971. Senator Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, before you is Senate File 971. This bill came about after a nurse in Tennessee was convicted of a criminally negligent homicide after she injected the patient with the wrong medication, causing the patient's death. This was a nurse who had dedicated her life to taking care of other people, and she had no criminal record. She grabbed the wrong medication that had a very similar name to the medication that was actually ordered. She made a mistake. Being a physician, I know the pressure that I live under every day and that my colleagues live under to never make a mistake, because when we make mistakes, the outcomes can be detrimental. However, healthcare providers are not robots, and by nature of being human beings, we simply cannot go through life without ever making a mistake. And so, when mistakes are made, we want people to come forward so that we can do what we can to fix those mistakes, so that we can analyze the systems that led to that mistake, and we can try to prevent those mistakes from happening again. If there is concern that if I were to make a mistake, I could go to jail, one, people will start hiding their mistakes. And two, people will not want to be caretakers. They will not want to be nurses and doctors and chiropractors and nurse practitioners and PAs. So this bill does not prevent investigation. This bill does not prevent the removal of a medical license. This bill does not prevent criminal charges to be brought up if an investigation reveals a crime. It simply states that that care providers will not be criminally prosecuted if they make an honest mistake, because an honest mistake should not constitute a crime. In your packets, you will have multiple letters of support. And with that, Madam Chair, we have some testifiers.
Thank you. First, Mr. Carlin, if you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 971. My name is Adam Carlin, and I serve as the Chief Nursing Officer at mHealth Fairview Southdale Hospital in Edina, and as Policy and Advocacy Chair for the Minnesota Organization of Leaders in Nursing. I want to thank Senator Mann for championing this bill and Senators Abler and Bolden for co-authoring it. As a nurse and leader in healthcare, I'm responsible for ensuring patients receive safe, high-quality care in an environment that fosters learning, accountability, and continuous improvement. At Southdale, our nurses, physicians, advanced practice providers, and allied health colleagues are committed day in and day out to caring for patients and families. I'm confident that my healthcare colleagues across Minnesota share the same commitment. One of the core principles in healthcare is just culture, an approach that promotes transparency and learning rather than blaming when system failures contribute to unintended mistakes. However, when healthcare providers fear criminal prosecution for errors, they become less likely to report them. This makes healthcare less safe. A tragic example is the recent case of a Tennessee nurse convicted of negligent homicide for a medication error that was influenced by system failures, outdated technology, and workflow issues. Her conviction sent shockwaves through the healthcare community. I know that mistake could have happened to me or any of my colleagues. Frontline providers often make split-second decisions in high-pressure environments, and it's our responsibility to ensure they feel safe to report errors so we can improve systems and prevent mistakes. This bill is essential to encourage transparency in reporting, support system-wide improvements, and to help retain healthcare workers. To be clear, this bill does not protect gross negligence, recklessness, or misconduct, nor does it limit patient rights. Individuals who act recklessly or with intent to harm will still be held accountable through criminal liability, licensing boards, and civil actions. However, an unintended error should not make someone a criminal. Some may ask, has this happened in Minnesota? While we may not have a similar case, we shouldn't wait for a tragedy before we act. We know that highly skilled and dedicated healthcare colleagues can still make errors, and we must strike a balance between accountability and compassion. This legislation promotes a culture of transparency and learning, encouraging individuals to report mistakes so that systems can be improved and future errors prevented, ultimately making our healthcare system safer for everyone. Thank you, Senators Mann, Abler, and Bolden, for your leadership, and I urge the committee to support Senate File 971 and would be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you. And now I have Dr. Patrice Narad on the list as a testifier.
Good morning.
Good morning. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Put my glasses on so I can actually see. Right? Oh, there. There. Chair Wicklund, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Dr. Patrice Narad, but I'm here to strongly oppose SF 0971, a bill that would grant broad immunity to healthcare providers from criminal liability. Supporters of this bill, including the Minnesota Hospital Association and Fairview Health Services, argue that this bill fosters a just culture by encouraging transparency and learning rather than blame. They claim that fear of prosecution discourages reporting mistakes, making healthcare less safe. But let's be clear. This bill is not about transparency. It is about eliminating accountability, shielding healthcare providers from legal consequences while leaving harmed patients and their families without recourse. We might well just ask the question, a just culture for whom? Certainly not for society as a whole, certainly not for the patients who suffer harm due to reckless or negligent care. This so-called just culture prioritizes the protection of providers over the well-being of those they are meant to serve. This kind of legislation forces irresponsibility onto others and discourages critical thinking that we so desperately need in this culture, ethical decision-making, and professional integrity within the healthcare system. And I would add some of our other systems as well. If providers are not held accountable for their actions, they will not be incentivized to maintain the highest standards of care. Furthermore, this bill is not just flawed in principle. It is fundamentally dangerous in practice. It attempts to extend immunity, a protection traditionally reserved for government actors, to private individuals in a profit-driven industry. This is a reckless expansion of legal privilege that would have long-term consequences on public trust, safety, and the rule of law. It effectively allows healthcare providers to operate above the law, making them unaccountable to the very people they are supposed to serve. Supporters claim that healthcare providers will be more likely to report errors if they don't fear criminal prosecution, but history shows that institutions allowed to self-regulate without meaningful oversight prioritize protecting their reputations over patient safety. Hospitals and health systems already have deeply entrenched cultures of silence when it comes to errors, malpractice, and misconduct. This bill would further enable this by giving providers and institutions even greater incentive to conceal mistakes rather than to address them openly. When we remove accountability, choice, and autonomy, we also remove the critical feedback loops that ensure justice, drive improvements, and inspire innovation. Immunity at this scale is the lowest level, and I've been an organizational development person in my past life. It is a shortcut to avoid dealing with complex but necessary issues of responsibility and ethical care. Instead of improving health care, it suppresses the very mechanisms that lead to safer, more effective treatment and greater public trust. And truthfully, you do need to restore public trust. Immunity literally creates an environment that enables bad practice, unethical behaviors, and malpractice, and it signals to providers that they are beyond legal reach. This bill also applies to, the way I read it now, any licensed or registered professionals providing health treatment under state law. That means not just doctors and nurses, but pharmacists, mental health professionals, dentists, social workers, chiropractors, and more. Are we truly prepared to grant this level of immunity to every person operating in healthcare, regardless of their role or proximity to patient care? This bill currently, as far as I understand it, casts far too wide a net, creating sweeping protections without adequate checks and balances. Proponents claim that this bill strikes a balance between accountability and compassion, but in reality, it offers no real accountability at all. The real balance must include both compassion and consequence, not an unchecked privilege that shields healthcare providers at the expense of those they harm. Unfortunately, I want to also confront the conflict of interest embedded in this legislation. Three of its co-sponsors are healthcare professionals who stand to benefit directly from the immunity they seek to establish. But this is just not an issue with this bill. It is a part of a larger, more erosive problem. Self-regulating systems in the judiciary, legal profession, and medical community have long prioritized protecting the reputation of their guilds over protecting the public. When doctors regulate doctors, lawyers regulate lawyers, and judges regulate judges, the public is left without true safeguards. These self-policing systems are designed to shield their members from scrutiny rather than hold them accountable. The major hospital networks like Fairview Health Services and the Minnesota Hospital Association have a vested interest in shielding their institutions from scrutiny, legal action, and financial liability. The more protections given to individual providers, the more hospitals are insulated from lawsuits and accountability. At its very core, this bill does not protect patients. We need more accountability, not less, more choice, not forced compliance, and more autonomy, not blind legal protections. The people of Minnesota deserve a healthcare system that assures patients and families have a clear path to justice, not another legal roadblock protecting providers and institutions at their expense. I urge you to reject SF0971 and focus on real reforms that improve patient safety while preserving accountability. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And we have one more testifier, I believe, on Zoom, Kelly Hagan. If Kelly, if you could unmute. And then Kelly is a chief nursing officer in International Falls. Kelly, please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Certainly. My name is Kelly Hagan, and as you mentioned, I'm the chief nursing officer in Rainy Lake Medical Center in International Falls. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in strong support of SF 971, which seeks to provide immunity from criminal liability for healthcare workers when delivering treatment and services in good faith. Thank you, Senator Mann, for championing this bill, and thank you, Senators Abler and Bolden, for co-authoring it. As I have served as a frontline caregiver over many years and as a nurse leader, I have had the firsthand witness of the challenges that healthcare providers face in delivering critical, often life-saving care under high-pressure circumstances. Unfortunately, as in any walk in life, mistakes do occur. And although there are very few and far between, such instances should never go without accountability. They should also serve as an opportunity to learn and reshape improvement processes in order to prevent similar events in the future. And we have all undertaken stringent work to ensure that errors are few and that we impact the ability for all of our healthcare workers to make those errors. However, the increasing risk of criminal prosecution for healthcare providers creates a chilling effect on medical decision making, discourages transparency, and may ultimately hinder that patient quality care. And the reason for that is then people do not come forward with issues so that we can work through the processes that could have prevented those issues from happening. This bill is essential to ensure that healthcare providers can focus on delivering the highest standard of care without the fear of criminal legal repercussions for unintentional outcomes. Healthcare providers already adhere to rigorous professional and ethical standards and are the subject to extensive civil and regulatory oversight. However, the growing trend of criminalizing mistakes places an undue burden on those of us dedicated to healing and saving lives. By granting immunity from criminal liability in cases where healthcare providers act in good faith and within the scope of their professional duties, SF 971 will support a culture of transparency and reporting, which does lead to better care for all. It will allow for system-wide improvements, giving providers more ability to focus on prevention rather than punishing individuals. And lastly, it will support recruitment and retention of healthcare workers. We already have a shortage of healthcare workers and are experiencing that workforce strain every single day. We want people to be able to pursue a career in healthcare without having to worry about being criminalized for making an error. For these reasons, I urge the committee to support SF 971 and protect the integrity of the healthcare profession, ensuring that providers can work without fear of criminal liability. It is necessary for the future of patient care. And it strikes a better balance between necessary accountability and deserved compassion. Thank you for your time today. I welcome any questions.
Thank you very much. That concludes the testifiers that we have. Members, do you have any questions? Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to Senator Mann and the testifiers. I just have a question to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. Nothing in this bill prevents suing in civil court, correct?
Senator Mann.
Madam Chair, Senator, that is correct. And I think there is perhaps some misunderstanding of what the bill does. This bill does not give blanket immunity to anyone. Because of this bill, doctors will not regulate doctors and nurses will not regulate nurses. The board still have that responsibility. Malpractice suits are not touched by this bill. You can still sue any care provider. I wanted to clear that up.
Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Mann. I appreciate that. I feel like in the last few years, we've seen a shift to criminalizing different portions of provider work, whether it's specific care procedures or just a change to how we expect to hold people accountable for their actions. And I think for me, when I think of criminality and what it means and when we as a society should use it, it has a real, I think we have a responsibility for it to have a reason of intentionality to it. Healthcare providers are in incredibly high-paced, high-stress, high-pressure situations where you have to make split-second decisions. And errors will happen. I think that's true. We make errors here all the time, and we don't go to jail for them. I think, there are consequences for that. The boards have accountability and consequences. There are civil consequences, but I think we should preserve criminality for when it is intentional or real harm is done due to, negligent behavior. I support this bill. I think I am very worried about the culture of the culture shift to criminalize providers in a way that makes me very nervous about care that is deeply needed in our communities. And I think that this has specifics. It's clear, it's to me not broad. And I will be supporting this moving forward.
Thank you. Senator Liske.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I have an amendment that I want to offer, the A1 amendment.
Senator Liske moves the A1 amendment. Can that be, please distribute that? And Senator Liske, if you could begin to describe what your amendment does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, my amendment is just another carve out to kind of go with the list of where the immunity would not fall. So it's going to go under section 609.215 subdivision 3. And I just so happen to have that statute right in front of me, so I'll read that for you. Subdivision 3 is acts or omissions not considered aiding suicide or aiding attempted suicide. So it's going to talk about you would not have immunity if you are omitting results or applications of medications that may lead to an attempted suicide. So that's the purpose of the amendment, and it's going to pull that part out of this bill.
Senator Mann.
Madam Chair, Senator. I'm a little taken aback and disappointed that you did not share this with me beforehand. So I don't know what the implications of this amendment are. I have not had the chance to talk to anybody, to any of the stakeholders, to any of the council. So at this time, I would respectively request a no vote, and I would welcome further conversations.
Senator Liske.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Unfortunately, I didn't have a lot of time to talk to you about it because I just got the amendment made this morning. Reading through your bill, we had talked about the bill as a whole, right? I understand the concept of fear of being criminally charged with things as a provider myself. My concerns are that the way the language is written, as one of the testifiers was pretty clear, is it's pretty broad and wide sweeping, and so it doesn't have any guardrails for things that might be considered a poor taste or a thing that we could make an error, which I don't know if that would be considered an error in my opinion, but overdosing a patient on a medication when they are, you know, in theory just having pain management. And so my concern is that there would be still criminal charges in an assisted suicide, and so that's where I want to carve this out, and so that's why this is so important.
Senator Liske, do we not already have criminal statutes that apply to, you know, assisted suicide?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Liske.
Thank you. I will just, so the way the bill is written, unfortunately, it takes that out. And so it would remove the liability side of the equation and overrule this portion of the equation. So that's partly why I want this in there, want this included. I'm really concerned that it could be associated with that realm of discussion.
And I guess I'm having a little bit of a hard time understanding how it would not be contained in some of the section subdivision 2, subdivision B and C, that some of the things that exist in law that protect against specific acts. But it is difficult to just assess that in the moment right now. Senator Utke, did you want to speak to this, or do you want to follow? Okay. Senator Abler, did you have something regarding the amendment?
Thank you. And you know, you want to sign a bill? Sure, it's a problem. Let's help the nurses and doctors. And I didn't think I would be carved out, so I guess I am. So now I won't have to go to jail. It's not a big deal in the chiropractic practice where we're even worried about these things. But I support the idea. And I suppose I could have called you, too. I hadn't thought about this implication. And I do believe, unfortunately, that Senator Mann, I think this, and to the supporters, I think this does not disallow that. And I don't believe it was your intent to create this little side opportunity. And I know it's a hugely controversial bill or topic. But I think if this becomes attached to the bill as a concern, it's not going to get out of the House. It's going to be hugely controversial in judiciary. They're limited for time, and so we don't have to pass this bill out today. But Senator Mann, I think this something not allowing some version of the A1 amendment will actually help your bill truly become law, because I know you don't intend this. So that's my suggestion. So I would just urge you to please accept an amendment of this nature, and then let's try to get the good the bill can do, because nobody intends this to be. So that's my advice. And so I would like to stay supporting the bill. Thank you.
Senator Mann, did you want to respond?
Madam Chair, so willfully overdosing a patient on a lethal medication is murder and under current state law, and it is illegal. This bill does not change that at all. And again, under subdivision 2, section B, it says very clearly that nothing in this section limits any liability for gross negligence or wanton, willful, malicious, or intentional misconduct. It's already all in there, Madam Chair.
Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this is a question for council, but is on line 1.1, just the beginning of subdivision 2A, notwithstanding any provision of law to the contrary, doesn't that specifically say this does not override existing law that that would cover the amendment?
Ms. Is that your, I don't know whose bill this is and who would like to comment? Mr. Hidalgo?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Port, in general, I would agree with your assessment, although I would note at the end of that same paragraph A, you'll see except as provided in paragraph B, and then those are the carve-outs. So okay. That notwithstanding itself has a carve-out, and so I think that's kind of where we're discussing fitting this amendment in. I would note, without having dug into this further, that Senator Mann's point that this may already be addressed in intentional or willful conduct, assisted suicide. My initial reading would be that it would already be covered, but it's certainly something that you know could necessitate looking into further. Thank you.
Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to Council. I think I agree with you. I think it's covered. I would worry about having to add in every single situation in which you know, we think that there needs to be a carve out and specifically lining them up one by one, which I think starting to do here would encourage and could potentially make it less sort of more difficult to do it when in not those cases that are specifically spelled out. So I agree with you. I don't think this amendment is needed.
Any other members wish to comment on the amendment before we vote on it? Senator Abler.
You know, we have a lot of time left in session. I think the bill is worthy. And anyway, wish we had more time to talk behind the scenes about this. I do believe it's a valid concern. I believe the notwithstanding in line 111, it says if something's illegal, you won't be charged if you do it. That's what that means. And so this is not a minor concern. And so, Senator Mann, if I think it would make sense just to lay the bill over, work on it. We could take it up. Once this is resolved with some solid opinions from somebody, more than just what do you think, and on the fly, which I think is a valid concern, but I think that would be the better way. We could take this up Thursday morning, and blink it out of here with, or at least get to the vote part. And then that concern would not trail on this bill. I think it needs to be addressed affirmatively, and I'm not sure what the vote would be on the amendment. I would intend to support the amendment. And I'm concerned about the bill going forward without some acknowledgement. The place for that to be handled on that topic is this committee. So I'm trying to be friendly to your bill and help it actually get across the finish line. So that's my counsel to you for whatever it's worth. Thank you.
Senator Mann, did you have any comments? Any preferences? The bill does need to go to judiciary, and I am concerned about not moving it on to judiciary because of just the fact that it takes a long time for for bills. And I'm concerned about carving out specific aspects in an area that it seems like a more judiciary-related discussion to decide whether something needs to be included or not included. Senator Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with that assessment. I would like to move it to judiciary because we were going to have very robust discussions in that committee about what is legal or not. Again, from where I'm standing, this issue is already covered. This would not change that at all, Senator Liske and Senator Abler. I will talk further with counsel, and if that changes, I will absolutely make changes to the bill if needed. I will also add that the bill did pass last year from both bodies of the Kentucky legislature unanimously, and this was not an issue that was brought up at that time.
Senator Liske?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, unfortunately, in my opinion, this bill is definitely not ready to be moving around and getting a positive hearing, because I still have serious heartburn over it. It's not something that I want to see pass our committee, go argue in judiciary, and then come back to us and we don't know what it looks like, or have it pass from judiciary and hit the Senate floor and now we're debating this for 16 hours about why this is, you know, these things are still not met. I don't think any of us want to spend 16 hours on a Senate floor listening to this bill specifically, because I think the intent of the bill is valid, right? We're concerned about the real life decision making that medical doctors, that chiropractors, that other providers, all healthcare providers make. So I understand the intent. The problem is that I don't think the intent is currently being met the way it's written. And so with that, I think we should be holding on to this bill and or at least passing this amendment, so at least I feel a little more comfortable, because something we've seen in the last few years is we pass things and then we realize we need to pull it back. And instead of passing things and pulling it back, we should hold on to it until it's ready.
So we're in a difficult, I would suggest we could lay it over and discuss it tomorrow, but if we find that it is a matter that is best discussed in judiciary, I believe we should pass it out and let them work on it, because there might be other things that come up that could be addressed in the same manner that you've called out this specific item. And I'm concerned about, you know, us doing that here. I do think that it would change the bill drastically. So, Senator Mann, if would you consider laying over the bill? We could bring it up tomorrow or Thursday and just have a brief discussion about, you know, what conclusion you and other senators have come to, and then we can vote on the amendment and move the bill along.
Sure, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Kupek, sorry.
So, Madam Chair, if we were to do that, is there, you know, I feel like I would like to hear from somebody of the legal, a lawyerly person besides our great counsel here, but somebody else who, you know, maybe could parse this out a little bit better. I feel like that's why I do feel judiciary does have, having sat through many judiciary hearings, that they love to parse things out. So is there somebody, if we are going to hold it over here, can we also bring in somebody to have a little more parse out on that? I feel like it would be better for understanding.
We can, if Senator Mann could, you know, if there is someone who could specifically address and wanted to testify. I think we've had testimony about the bill. I think it would be best to work on it in the background. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having spent years because of a family member dealing with this, this bill is not ready. I would vote against it right now. If I do the number counter on the table, that's 5-5. That means your bill dies. So I would advocate that the author of this bill table this bill and go talk to Senators Abler and Liske and figure out a path, because I could never support this bill as it sits because of things like may, shall, any harm. You got this scope that is very ambiguous in definition, and having multiple sued to having to deal with this system, this is not, I can't support this bill. So you want it, you want the bill, let's take it up, 5-5, it dies, or you can work with the two people that have raised issue on it. But Madam Chair, that's how I sit on this one, so thank you.
Any other comments? I think we will lay the bill over and we'll discuss, and the bill will be posted again when we are gonna take it up. The Senate file 971 is laid over. And seeing that is the end of our business before us, we are adjourned.